listening to the Getting to the Heart of It with Sarah podcast. As the co-founder and CEO of To Road Solutions, we support our first responders, Australian Defence Force veterans, and other emergency services personnel in their transition to post-service employment with purpose. People are the heart of our business, which is how Getting to the Heart of It was created. You'll have the honour of hearing firsthand stories from the ones who have or who are still serving our beautiful country. You can expect real and raw conversations with our heroes. So hop in, hold on for the ride, while you ignite your own sense of purpose as you navigate your way through the ups and downs of life and seek insight through others' experiences. This is where we get to the heart of it.
In this podcast episode called The Best Exercise for Your Heart is to Help Somebody Else Stand Up, Sarah caught up with Roger Eichler, a former police officer who shares his challenging stories to help inspire others. Roger is now a published author and uses his book as a way of giving back and continuing to support our communities. Let's dive in.
Welcome to the Getting to the Heart of It podcast. It's lovely to have you here. So you're a former New South Wales police officer serving in rural New South Wales. You spent 17 years in service and were medically discharged in 2008. You're currently working for the federal government and you are also a volunteer with a number of not-for-profit organisations. So I think it would be really good if you started with your policing career and what led you to spend 17 years in the New South Wales police force.
Well, I left school in 1984 and I really had no career aspirations of what to do for a career apart from joining the Defence Force. But a friend of mine was going off to join the New South or applied to join the New South Wales Police Force, and he suggested that I should give it a go as well because, you know, I like the discipline sort of thing, which is sort of similar to the Defence Force.
Yeah.
And we both walked into Campbelltown Police Station, and back in those days there was just forms on the counter that you filled out, and we filled them all out and we went through the whole process, and I got in and he didn't because he was too short. Because back in those days, they only took people above 5'9".
Oh, right. Yeah. So, I wouldn't have got in either. They didn't like the shorties.
It took about another 3 years before they started to accept people that were short.
Okay.
You had to be a certain stature and all those sorts of things back in those days.
You know?
Yeah. And I started to really enjoy it, and it clicked with me. And I've always been, and my whole family has always been, one to give to the community. And that's what policing is about, like doing community service.
Certainly is. So what was it like for you working in the New South Wales Police Force? You'd have a few stories to tell.
I've got plenty of stories to tell. And I grew up in the bush, south between Sydney and Wollongong. And I did all my service in the bush across New South Wales. I did 7 stations in 17 years across New South Wales. Look, I loved it. I loved the community work. And what I loved about rural police work was you get to feel the culture of the community. You get to know people and you see the end result of, A, what you do to help the community, like changing the paths of whoever's, you know, life or whatever, but you also get to see the end result of all the jobs that you deal with. Like you get a major bust on some sort of incident and you see it from start right through to finish. Instead of like in a big station, in the city stations, you hand a big incident over to the detectives or some other crime investigator or so on. And that's what I love. Like I did big drug busts, I did big accidents and house fires, and you do the whole lot. So you learn everything from doing crime scene analysis back in those days because we didn't have any crime scene officers out in the bush, doing photography, doing coronial briefs, interviewing everybody, suspects, victims, all those sorts of things, witnesses, putting the whole brief together, doing the whole thing and coming together, taking it to the courts, whichever one it might be, and, end result is, getting a result.
That would have been really interesting because working in rural communities, you would have known a lot of the community.
Absolutely. And that was the toughest part because when something really bad or sad happens, you know them personally. And that's what took a lot of the toll on me because you become emotionally attached to the people in the community, especially the smaller towns that I lived and worked in. Mm. You know people. You know Mary. And when Mary dies at home, you're the one investigating it and you help carry her out to the ambulance or whatever or other, and you say goodbye to her and console the family and you go to the funerals because you know them personally. Yeah. I went to some really, really tragic stuff with some personal friends, and it's not really nice when a young gentleman who was struggling with his sexuality takes his life and he's a friend of yours. That was really, really tough. Really, really tough. Yeah. But, you know, when you saw the end result of some kids that you're dealing with who are not doing the right thing, and then they come up to you 2 or 3 years later and shake your hand and say, thanks for kicking us up the bum, Rog.
Mm.
Yeah, we were going down the wrong path and you led us in the right direction. And you become a mentor to those sort of people and helping save people's lives. You know, like a young girl who was threatening self-harm, had herself locked in a house with a knife and so on, and you go in, you console her and you help her. Yeah, she, of course, you know, we have to restrain her and take her to hospital, and then months later she comes over and gives you a hug and thanks you for your support in saving her life. They're the things that give you a warm heart.
Yeah and keeps you going, I'm sure.
Absolutely. It's emotionally draining.
Yeah, and I was going to say to you, what were some of the strategies that you used, you know, when you're attending those really challenging events, and it's not, you know, this is on a day-to-day basis that you would be doing this. It's a regular thing. So what were some of the strategies that you implemented? What were some of the tools that you used to get through this?
Well, in the small rural communities, a lot of people wouldn't know this, but back then, I don't know if it still happens now, but it probably would, but to a lesser extent, your partner at those little stations, like your wife or husband or whoever you've got, is your sounding board because there's nobody else there. Like I was in stations where I was a single officer or was only two officers and the other guy's not there because, you know, the position was vacant. So you offload to your partner, your loved ones and so on and try your best. But so was the culture back then, and it probably still is. You sort of bottle it up and it becomes unhealthy. And so you cope in a not so good way by finding solace in a bottle, you know, and you have sessions where you just basically drown your sorrows and stuff like that. What I should have done, and I did a little, I was seeing professionals for a while, but I was too young to understand how much I should have let out.
Okay.
I was still bottling things in. I should have spoken more openly about it, and especially when I took my wife, I didn't want to let her know that I was suicidal.
Yeah.
I didn't want to let her know that I was really, really struggling because you're the husband. You're the man of the house. You're meant to be strong and stoic. No, you're not. You're meant to let them know that you're struggling. But that's what happened back then. Today, because we're talking more about it, we're becoming more open with our feelings, and it's not that bad when you finally tell your partner. It's bloody tough to tell them that you're suicidal or having those sort of thoughts. But it ends up, it's that honesty thing. I didn't use enough of the strategies that I'm using today that I should have used 20 years ago. And, you know, I'm paying the permanent price for it. You know, I still struggle with a lot of stuff.
Yeah, but that's it. We can only use the tools that we've got in our toolbox at that time, can't we?
Correct.
Correct. You know, if we only knew then what we knew now, life certainly would be a lot easier. But
absolutely. And we keep yelling. Well, you see all these forums and hear all these things that, the bosses should have taken your side and done this, done that. They don't understand how to deal with those sort of things.
Yeah.
They're not psychologists, psychiatrists, psychotherapists, whatever. They're just the same as you. They might wear a higher rank, but they don't understand how to deal with this sort of stuff.
No, that's
right. They've got no concept whatsoever, unless they're totally trained. But the training that you receive in any organisation is not enough to help their work colleagues suffering with mental health.
Mm. Yeah. I think in terms of our management and leadership, though, they definitely should have that training to be able to identify what, you know, when someone is struggling and so they can at least reach out and point them in the right direction.
Exactly. And just steering them in the right direction, not taking them into a room and debriefing them and all that, just having a cup of tea with them. Mm. Are you okay? Look, here's some services. How about I make the call? I'll leave the room. You talk to them, whatever, anything. But don't bring a bottle into it. Don't take them to the pub, because that sort of stuff just makes it unhealthy.
But just on the debriefing, if a crew got together after they attended a critical incident and they returned to the station and they debriefed, wouldn't that be helpful?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But because you're going from job to job to job to job to job in some of the areas that I worked in, so you get back and you go, oh, that was shit, or excuse the language, that was shit, that was tough, blah, 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 and you just start writing up the case and then you get a call, you've got to go.
So it
interrupts the whole process.
Right.
And because there's always been and always will be a chronic shortage of staff in a lot of stations, you don't have the time to sit down and just chew the fat. And usually with like a massive incident like fatals, multiple fatalities or whatever it might be, the shock and horror and stuff that comes from it doesn't happen that day. It doesn't impact you that much that day. It's the next day, the day after that, where it finally starts to sink in and really take effect. Like the first time I was diagnosed with PTSD was back in 99, and I arrested a kid while I was off duty and he nearly killed me with a pair of scissors. It wasn't until a week or two later that my wife said, you're not right, you need to see someone. So it took a couple of weeks for it to finally come in. And then I did another 8 years of service and had another 1,000 incidents thrown at me after that.
It's just so tough. You know, my hat goes off to all of the first responders out there who have to deal with these horrific incidents every single day. I want to come back to, you know, you were talking about working at a small station and having that opportunity to learn so many different jobs and roles. And it blows my mind when I hear from our first responders, you know, when they're on my program, my life after service program, and they sit there and say, well, we don't know what we could potentially be. Like, what skills do we actually have? Where if you sit down and think about it, they have got so many transferable skills. Being able to remain calm in an emergency situation is a huge skill on its own. Yep. So what are some of the transferable skills do you think that you picked up along the way?
Look, I'm ex-cop, you know, I've got all sorts of transferable skills. Nothing on paper, and that's the biggest thing when you get out of the service, there's nothing on paper that says you're smart, you can do this, you've got these sort of things. And it took me ages to finally have something that helped me understand my transferable skills. But eventually, workplace health and safety, we can do WHS stuff really, really well. Security and risk management skills. Understanding how to look at a situation and go, that's a danger, that's an issue, here's a risk-related matter. You know how to create and work with stakeholders so that you can get actions. You know, think of going to a bloody house fire or whatever it might be and you're yelling at people to do A, B, C, and D and you're the command of that situation. You can do that in a office environment and say, John, you need to go and do this. Bill, you need to do that. Mary, you need to go and do that. And we're going to come together and this is what we're going to produce at the end of the day. Communication skills. I've worked in local government situations where I've been basically the crime investigator for the local council, and being able to do crime scene analysis, looking at environmental impact stuff. I love EPA work, like looking at environmental situations and being able to get people to comply with the orders that you're telling them to do to rectify a illegal clearing of land or dumping of waste or whatever it might be. Still compliancy sort of stuff, but it's in a softer version, much softer version. And those sort of transferable skills are fantastic. And that's what those organisations want. They want people that know how to look at a crime scene, even though it's not a car wreck or whatever, but you're looking at somebody that's just dumped a whole heap of asbestos and getting compliance for them to do the cleanup. And if not, you get it cleaned up and send them the bill. So these are the sort of transferable skills as an ex-cop that we have. And local government organisations and other government organisations look for us because we can do those sort of things standing on our head. And when you're dealing with those situations, you're not dealing with people who are toxic, filled with drugs and alcohol and all those fueled things that coppers come across in their everyday job. You're dealing with some silly builder who needed to get rid of his rubbish and he just dumps it out on the side of the road. They're not a dangerous compliance situation. It's a much softer compliance situation, and we find it so easy to deal with those sort of things.
That is brilliant. And I think we need to talk more about that, about all of those transferable skills that are learnt.
Yeah. Absolutely. And records management. Oh. Like I'm doing records management. Cops know how to do records management so well.
For sure.
Getting documents, storing them electronically, putting them there, all those sorts of things. Because we deal with exhibits. We deal with crime scene stuff. We know how to safely secure things and put it away.
Did you want to talk any more about some of the biggest challenges throughout your career?
Look, the challenges in my career, there was many, because I worked in a number of small situations, small locations, I should say, across New South Wales, and just having the support out in those remote locations, especially after critical incidents, as I said. Some of the great things that I was able to do, as I touched on before, was dealing with big crime scene matters. And working with stakeholders in different states. I was at a station called Euston, which is out in the southwest of New South Wales, over near the South Australian border, and I pulled over a car one night, and one of the guys in the car was a known drug courier, and I found just short of $400,000 in the car. And he said a friend lent him the money to build a house, which is a very feasible answer, right?
Not when you've got a criminal
history. Yeah, exactly. What happened was the investigation turned into he was charged with being in possession of property that was likely stolen or otherwise unlawfully obtained, of course. But a silly friend of his said, I lent him the money, and I'm quite happy to give a statement regarding that. So I was able to work with stakeholders in South Australia at COPS and the ATO and worked with them. And through that, I discovered that he was one of the couriers for a lot of the drugs that this guy was transporting from Sydney down to South Australia. This friend owned a trucking company, and he was transporting the heroin around the state, of course, but he wasn't paying his taxes. So the ATO closed down the trucking company because they needed a bit of money.
Yeah.
So I was working with all these sort of things, and that's what cops can do. Getting back to that, that's what cops can do. We can work with stakeholders so well to get results.
And also working like community engagement. It's what you do so easily, isn't it?
Absolutely.
In difficult situations.
A funny story is, of course, when the 2000 Olympics was on, a hell of a lot of police had to go to Sydney to work up there, and I was just doing my thing and talking to people, and I was able to negotiate with a lot of stall holders with food and beverage for my co-workers at the end of the day, and I was taking back trays of sandwiches and rolls and all the leftover foods and coffees and all that sort of stuff. And they're going, Roger, how the hell do you do that? Well, you just talk to them, you say, how you going, blah, blah, blah. You build up a relationship.
That's right.
And they go, look, I'm going to throw this in the bin. Do you guys want it as a gift? Yeah, I don't want any money, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, sure, I'll take it back to the guys, blah, blah, blah. And they're going, Roger, how the hell do you do this? You did
how
it every day.
Is that?
And you just build these sort of relationships. Who knows? Years later, you might bump into them again and, I remember you from the Olympics. And it's just what you do. If you're able to communicate well and build relationships, you get results. And in my 17 years, I treated every single one of my clients, customers, victims, whatever, every single one of them with respect. And I was respected, and I was never assaulted by any of my people that I had to arrest out in the middle of nowhere. And I was able to take them back to the station, do what I got to do with them, and then I would gladly take them home, treat them with respect and dignity. And at the end of the day, they all pleaded guilty, and I never had any issues at court because they know they got busted. They shook my hand, and the next day they meet you in the pub and they go, I'll buy you a beer, Roger, for treating me like a gentleman.
That's it, and you treated them like just a human being, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely.
They might have made a mistake or two, but.
Yeah, and I got results, always got results, And in some of those circumstances, a lot of my bosses got pissed off because they couldn't do it. Yeah, they had a bit of animosity and all that sort of stuff, but so what?
I think that happens in just about all workplaces.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But yeah. But yeah, you know, as the years progressed and all those jobs, you know, built up, you know, I started to get up very, very, very unhealthy. Very, very unhealthy.
So I guess that's kind of a good segue into what led to your decision to leave. So after 17 years in the service, what do you think it was? Was it one thing that led you to make that decision, or was it a multiple?
Funnily enough, it wasn't my decision. As you said before, I wrote a book, and I had to write a book about my story as a cathartic thing to help offload a lot of stuff. And I was transferred to Coomer from Euston in end of 2003, and I was a very unhealthy man by the time I moved to Coomer, but I just didn't notice it. More jobs piled up and piled up and piled up, and then one night in 2006, 22nd of August 2006 actually, I was out on patrol by myself while my workmate was back in the office doing some paperwork, really, really quiet night, and I was just going past a couple of my drug dealers' houses and just seeing if anything suspicious was happening. And I saw these two shadows run into the distance from the drug dealer's house. And I thought, well, what should a copper do? You know, if you see some people running away from a police car, what do? You think they're up to something no good. So I took chase. And unfortunately, I ran over one of them, and I parked on his back, and I took the police car off him, and I rolled him over. It was a 15-year-old boy. As it happens in the police service and in a couple of other New South Wales government agencies, when a critical incident occurs, instead of having the investigation dealt with internally, they do the investigation and hand it over to the DPP, Department of Public Prosecutions, mm-hmm. and I was charged with two serious offences. I was sent to court, and the magistrate threw the whole matter out. Even though I was so unhealthy, I pleaded guilty to the lesser of the two charges. The magistrate didn't understand why, but the fact of the matter was that I was at the courthouse that day looking at where I could take self-harm. And the magistrate threw the whole matter out. He said, it was just a tragic accident. You did what a policeman should have done, mm-hmm. and a tragic accident occurred. The very next morning, my commander rang up and told me at home that my services are no longer required. And he signed my medical discharge. And I didn't even ask for it. I didn't apply for it. I didn't want it. I wanted to stay in the service. I just wanted to go somewhere where I could get a desk job, say at the academy, filing papers. I never wanted to leave the service, but my decision was taken from me because my commander didn't want me in the service anymore. Don't ask me why. So it wasn't my decision, but now, 15 years later, I look back, but I just wish I had that decision to make, that I made the decision to leave instead of just him going, you're no longer in the job. It would have been a much healthier departure from the service because I held on to a lot of anger and mistrust and hatred, very unhealthy thoughts for many, many years.
That decision was taken from you.
Yeah. Yeah, I was not in a very healthy way at all. And during that whole process from when I had the accident to when I went to court, it was during that time that I actually went to Sydney to go and see the New South Wales police psychologist, and he was interviewing me, and I took my wife as a support person, and it was that day that I announced to my wife that I was suicidal. She knew I was, but it was her birthday. And what a birthday present to give my wife. Happy birthday, darling. I want to kill myself. She knew I was not well. She knew I wanted to take my life. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, it was that day. And I was given no opportunity for rehab or therapy or anything or other like that. Absolutely nothing. And then the boss just said the day after court, goodbye, see ya. That was it.
So since then, 15 years ago, you've done a lot of healing. And a lot worked on your recovery. And part of your recovery, like you mentioned earlier, was writing your own book. So
absolutely.
You have written your own book called The Price of Protecting Others. When did you publish that one?
I published it. It was published, and I did a book launch in July last year. And I did it through my I'm a member of the Ballingendore Rotary Club, and I did it as a fundraising exercise for Rotary mental health programs. We only had 70 people come to the event, but we invited family and friends. And we made $1,500 on that day for Rotary Mental Health Programs. And through that, I still support Rotary Mental Health Programs, doing public speaking, doing what I'm doing now with you. But I also support two other not-for-profit organisations with mentoring with veterans of emergency services. But on that day, finally, I was able to say in front of all my family and my friends the impact of it all. And I was literally crying in front of everybody. And my mum was there, and she could never understand what was going on and why I was pushing her away. And I pushed my dad away as well, but he's passed, and I was never able to be honest with him. But a lot of my family and friends, they were crying. I was literally crying in front of them as I was releasing my book to them. It took me 6 years to write this book, and the very first version was very, very toxic, very toxic. I would encourage anybody who has the patience just to sit down and just put it on paper, just blurt it all out, all your anger, your hatred and all that sort of stuff. And what I did during this process of writing my book, one night about 4 years ago, I burnt all my police memorabilia, absolutely everything. I had a cathartic experience where I lit a bonfire out in the backyard and I just burnt everything I owned that I had from the police force. I had my uniforms, I had briefs, you know, all my big war stories, all my big briefs that I thought I was so proud of. I thought the kids would be interested. I had all my court case. I kept all the files, absolutely everything. And it was just keeping poison in the cupboard. It was just two toxic boxes of stuff sitting there that I thought I had. And it's not my identity. My identity is I'm a loving father with three kids who love me and want to be with me and want to talk to me every day. That is my identity.
That's right.
And I had to do that. I had to burn all that stuff to get rid of it.
What a great tool. Yeah.
And the book, look, I'm not going to retire on the income from it, but it's a great experience to write it, publish it, have family people read it and get it out there. And I'm still doing talks about the book when I go to different Rotary clubs, just to get it out there and let people know that there's a lot of us out there that are suffering, that get out of the job, and we need to talk about it. Absolutely. And that's why I support those not-for-profit organisations, and I work with veterans through that. It's not trying to be a counsellor. It's just being a mate that's quite open to talking about mental health. Are you struggling? Do you need a hand? Do you want a coffee? Do you want to meet up?
Are you able to just to provide a little bit of an overview on that book?
The book is my story, story of how I came to be Roger. I come from a German immigrant family who came to Australia. Yeah, I was born in Australia. I have two identities. I'm either German or Aussie. And all those, and there's many of us out there like that. You're either, I was a wog and I'm still a wog, you know.
Yeah.
I still eat schnitzel and sauerkraut and all that sort of stuff, yeah. But the book was, and it tells my story from when I joined the cops all the way through until 2019. When I thought I was being a rescuer and I did something really, really stupid because I was so unhealthy, and I texted my wife's boss and told him he was a dick by the way he was treating my wife. And that's not a really clever thing to do, apparently.
No, it's not really.
34 years later, we're still married and she still loves me and she understands why I did it. But, yeah, I was not healthy at the time. We separated. Lived under the same roof. We separated for a while and I did a lot of thinking, and that's why I burnt all my stuff, because it was just killing us. It was killing us. Mm. And if anybody's out there and still has their uniform and all that stuff, burn it. Get rid of it. Don't throw it in the bin because it's still there. Go out to a campsite, do a ritual burning. Like I did, I toasted it with a glass of wine. Get lost. Good night. Goodbye. It is so cathartic. It is good. And I wrote the book and I finished the book. And I published it, and my wife wrote the last chapter as to how we came about and how 35 years ago we thought we're going to be like this. No, we're the same loving couple. We're just a different version.
What an absolute credit to your wife for supporting you through some of the most difficult times in your life.
Oh, damn and, right. Oh.
And I don't think we acknowledge partners as much as we should, and family.
No. Yeah, and Libby was a mentor as well for a period of time for the partners of ex-cops or cops. But a lot of them struggle with being able to communicate with their partners, and that's the thing. You've got to get couples counselling. You've got to find somebody that can do that, or go to your church, go to your pastor, go to someone and just talk about it openly, don't get violent, don't swear or anything. It just, it's an understanding of, because we're damaged with PTSD, our brain thinks differently. You know, as like many of us, we've got to take happy pills, and for a long, long time, we just think and operate differently. We have things that trigger us. Like when we're sitting at a restaurant or whatever it might be, we can't sit with our backs to the door. You know, she gets that. She asks me all the time, are you okay? Blah, blah, blah. It's just, we're just a different animal now to what we were 30 odd years ago or whatever it is, because the job takes its toll. And that's why I call it the price of protecting others. The price is that we end up sometimes we're damaged, we're protecting others, we did our bit, pat yourself on the back for doing a bloody good job. It's time to move on once you put the uniform away and burn it. And we've got so many skills that we can get a decent job. We might not earn the big bucks, but you're not working in a stressful environment.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, congratulations on publishing your book. I think that is a huge achievement. And certainly a good way of working through some of your stuff and letting go of some of that trauma. Yeah. Writing is a great way of doing that.
Yeah. And the feedback I'm getting has been fantastic. Yeah. People cry because of, they just had no idea. Like some of our closest family and friends had no idea. And you don't tell them because you're trying to protect them.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You don't want to tell them that you had your hands in somebody's stomach holding, you know, things together so that a person doesn't die. You don't want people to know that sort of stuff.
Touching on your recovery journey in a little bit more detail, are you able to work us through, you know, what that was like for you, what kind of organisations you reached out to? I know you mentioned earlier some, you know, alternative therapies, which can also be really good in terms of complementing other therapies.
Look, I've never been one just to take the word of the doctor, because just because the doctor says so doesn't mean he is correct. You know, doctors can make a mistake, or they can, you know, not know all the answers. They specialise in a certain thing. You know, but there's other parts to your mental health journey of recovery, and I hate that word journey, but there's no other better word for it. Look, I've gone into studying and doing mindfulness, meditation, yoga, exercise is huge for your mental health recovery. Eating right, how you fuel your body is so important. Steering away from sugar, salt, fat, carbohydrates, junk food. I haven't eaten McDonald's for years, and all those sorts of things. So I steer away from all of that. Eating a cleaner, healthier diet. Try and stick to the rules. This is what we try and do. Look, and you can't go on a trajectory from A to B and be perfect all the way. We have our ups and downs like anything else, but we try and stick to a rule of no booze on a school night. So from Monday to Friday, no alcohol. Steer away from that stuff. Steer away from soft drinks and all those sorts of things, energy drinks, all of that. But I've also gone to an organisation called Quest for Life, where they teach you over a week-long period to do mindfulness and meditation and being able to communicate openly. Another organisation who works very, very closely with a lot of veterans from Defence Force and Emergency Services is called Trojan's Trek. And that's down in South Australia. You go into the Flinders Ranges for a week away, and you don't trek, you don't walk 1,000 kilometres. The trek is a journey in your head from point A to point B, and it teaches you how to speak clearer and more succinctly with your loved ones. And it's all taught by ex-participants. So having the lived experience of dealing with your own mental health struggles, and we mentor others to deal with their own mental health struggles. And it's using neuro-linguistic programming, so reprogramming your head in how to communicate more effectively instead of yelling and screaming and all that sort of stuff, being able to explain things a little bit better, using a softer tone, using love in your language, using expression and all that sort of stuff, being able to communicate with your health professional a lot better. I've worked with a myriad of psychologists, and I've done cognitive behaviour therapy. I've done exposure therapy, which is not really good. Don't do it, guys. I've done eye movement desensitization routine, EMDR, all those sorts of things. I've tried all of that and done all of that. But I also understand that with your health practitioner, whether it's a psychologist, a doctor or whatever, in my opinion, they have a life expectancy. And after about 2 to 3 years, I move on to somebody else. Because especially with psychologists, you get to a point where nothing else is working. So refresh it. Start with somebody else because they've got a different approach.
Yeah.
They might be a different age. They might have a different way of teaching or training or whatever it might be.
Mm.
And trying something new, something refreshing. And instead of just relying, I've seen 3 psychiatrists, and those 3 psychiatrists were more loony than me. One of them didn't believe in post-traumatic stress disorder. And he told me, I'm just in a tough job. Get over it. Get back to work. But you've got ADHD. And he just wanted me to go on Ritalin. Another psychiatrist told me I was weird with the way that I was dealing or had my mental health concerns. You know, having sexual dysfunction and everything is just weird. Here, you need lithium. You've got a brain disorder. Take lithium. And the third guy said that I would never be any better than a gardener. You've got a broken head. Take these 6 pills. Goodbye.
So, you've really got to trust your own self, don't you? On the guidance that you receive. And if it just doesn't feel right, I think you know the best thing to do is kind of let it go and find some guidance that does sit well with you.
And thank God with my wife. My God, why is she still with me? I don't know. But she has been my advocate for my health, and she's been with me in most of this journey. And she has been there in the room with me with my first couple of visits to any psychologist or psychiatrist and helped them understand where I'm coming from. Because when you're in there talking to whoever, you're speaking to that professional out of a head that's broken.
Mm.
She's sitting there as the observer, and she says, no, it's not like that, Roger. You do this, don't you? Oh, yeah, I do. Oh, I do that. Oh, right, yeah. So she has been my advocate to explain it better at times. Today I don't need her because I've done 15 years of this sort of treatment, therapy and all that sort of stuff. But in the early days, she had to be there to help explain to them how I am behaving, what I'm doing. Because when you're newly broken, you've got mental health issues. You've got mental health concerns. Everybody else are a nut. You're normal, you think. You think you're just normal and everybody else are crazy. But when you have your wife or partner or whoever with you there, they go, nah, Roger's of a nighttime kicking out and screaming and yelling and broken sleep and drinking too much and blah, 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 blah. So she has been my advocate, and now I am able to be my own advocate.
Wow, that is an extraordinary story, and such a beautiful, beautiful person that you have supporting you and being your advocate.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think you've given some really, really good guidance there for people, and there's more organisations out there than what people know to support first responders. So
absolutely,
Quest for Life and Trojan's Trek, was it?
Trojan's Trek.
Trojan's Trek in South Australia. Yeah, that's brilliant. So just on some closing thoughts now. So looking back on your career, what do you think one of the most memorable moments was that you had?
Most memorable? Oh, look, there's so many little jobs that you do that you walk away and you go, oh, yeah, I got a buzz out of that, got a buzz out of that. And I had a fantastic career and worked in some wonderful places. And there's no particular job that I think was just outstanding or situation. It was, look, when we lived out at Euston, it was the toughest but the best experience of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was extremely tough working out there. But we met some fantastic people and worked in a beautiful part of the state. But no, we've had a great experience our whole career. Like I say our career because my wife was with me every step of the way.
Yeah,
she was the person answering the station door after hours while I was out on the road. So she was my offsider through thick and thin. Just being able to, being out in those places, connecting more with our family, because to get a break from the station life, because people would knock on your door at any hour, even if you're off duty. We connected with our kids so closely because we would go away camping in the camper trailer or in a tent or whatever it might be, and we connected with our kids so well through the whole experience in the police force. And as I said, we've got 2 kids that live overseas and 1 in Queensland, and they want to talk to me every day. They want to talk to me. their dad, instead of having an estranged relationship and ending up really, really, really broken and sick, they love me and adore me and they want to connect with me every day. So there's always something on any of our messages that we use, you know, and all that sort of stuff. We're always in communicato, and they love to take the piss out of me when I'm with them face to face. You know, they love to lay on my lap and tell me how stupid I am as a dad and cracking stupid jokes and all that sort of stuff. And I just love it. I just love it. You know, instead of having kids that hate me because I was not very well, the best experience is being a loving husband and a loving father. I'm no longer a broken ex-cop.
Yeah.
That's part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
It's affected my life. It's going to be with me until I go. Number one, I'm dad. Number two, I'm a husband, or vice versa. Yeah. That is the best thing out of this job. It brought resilience into our family and love and respect for each other.
I love that so much. I love that, that family connection. And it's so, so important. Yep. And I've just found in my own discussions with first responders and ADF veterans as well is the importance of actually having those connections outside of the service.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I've got mates that I still keep in touch with, but I don't want to speak cop talk all the time. I've got some great advocates and friends.
Yep.
But we don't speak every day and we don't talk about cop work all the bloody time when we're together either. You know, we talk about other stuff. You know, no need to rehash it every day. And as you know, when you get together, you don't have to say too much to your ex-colleagues. You get each other. You understand each other. You just talk about a situation. You go, oh, yeah, whatever, yep. And then you move on. You got to have a healthy balance.
If you could just take a couple of minutes now to think of some wise words that you'd like to share with some troops that may be in a position that you were, so some that are that are, you know, following your footsteps, I suppose, or that are considering leaving the service. Yeah. What would you share with them? What's some guidance that you'd share with them? Some wise words.
Yeah. Okay. Your uniform is not your identity. It's something that you put on every day, but it is not you. It is not what's going to be you for the rest of your life. Number two, be open about the days that you struggle. Tell your partner, tell your boss, tell whoever that you're with on the day, whenever day you're having a struggle or you've had a bad night or whatever. Yeah, I'm not well today. I just need to take it a bit easy. I might have to walk out of the office for an hour, whatever. And as emergency services, we have a myriad of transferable skills. And yes, you might be looking at jobs that don't pay the money that the police force is. Like, I'm earning probably about half of what I used to earn in the cops. And I don't care because I'm now in a safe, productive working environment. I'm not dealing with stressful stuff every day. I'm still contributing to the workforce. Mm-hmm. I still do my community service. But you don't need that stress from the job every day anymore. You don't need to live on adrenaline every day. And you need to have a loving, supporting environment around you. That is so important because if you don't have that loving, supporting environment, you're going to become sicker and sicker and end up, you know, who knows. I'm about to bury an old police friend who became an alcoholic and lived out in a shipping container out in the bush for years. You know, he became so sick.
That's really tough.
Yeah. And one of my old colleagues, she died from drinking two cartons of beer every day. So it's she literally drank herself to death at age 52, literally died from alcohol disease at 52.
Yeah, so sad. Yeah. Alcohol is not the answer at all.
No.
There's some really, really, really good points that you've raised, and the ones that you have raised seem to be quite often come up in conversations that I have and even on my program as well is – people struggle with that loss of identity. They don't know what their transferable skills are, and the importance of having that connection outside of the service, staying connected. So some really great points there. Thank you so much.
There is a brotherhood outside of the service. You just got to find it. And that's why I volunteer with these organisations, because there's always a sprinkling of veterans from whatever service there, and we just chat and all that sort of stuff, and we get each other. And we don't have to explain the dark days or whatever situation it is, but there is that brotherhood. And if you just send a message and go, I'm struggling, somebody's going to touch base with you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Great advice. Roger, I would like to thank you so much for your service. And yeah, it has you. Been a pleasure listening to your story. So
thanks very much, Sarah.
If you enjoyed this episode, please hit subscribe to make sure you never miss a show. If you or someone you know could benefit from real support with their transition from service, please reach out to Sarah or Robert McComas from Tarode Solutions. We can assist you in providing employment opportunities that align to your values and purpose. Check out the services we provide at Tarode Solutions by visiting www.tarodesolutions.com.au.